Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, hour two's here. Let's make the most of it. The number is 888-914-9149. Do you need a second opinion? Do you need some advice? You have a question? Maybe you heard me say something you didn't like or you didn't agree with and you want to, I don't want to say duke it out because that never happens here, but you know, you want to discuss? I'm here for you. Call me, 888-914-9149. We'll start off with Rod in Eureka, California. Hello, Rod.
Hi, Patrick. So my question, my father has dementia. He's had it for years. And my wish and my prayer has been for years for God to restore his mind. And so my question is, why would God honor the wishes of demons when the demons said, you know, they asked Jesus to go into pigs and Jesus honored that? But he won't honor my wishes, which I love. I love Jesus, and the demons don't love Jesus. But God honors their wish above mine. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't seem like God's will to me.
Mm-hmm. I can see the dilemma. I can see it. I think the way out of the dilemma, Rod, is it's twofold. But let me start with the first one, and that is that Jesus wasn't giving the demons preferential treatment by acquiescing to their plea that they be sent into the swine. He made an object lesson out of them. And so there are a couple layers here that I think. Number one, swine were like, you know, as you know, the Jews consider them to be the filthiest of unclean animals. And so the fact that the demons were cast into the swine is an insult to them, number one. And number two, it just showed how helpless and defenseless the demons are before the power of Jesus Christ. So they were begging Jesus for something, anything to go into, and they went into the swine. And of course, you know what happened with the swine. They went crazy. They went over the cliff. They all drowned. So the demons are back out of those bodies now roaming around. So I would look at it. I think this is one way to assuage your concern here would be to say, this was not an example of God, you know, giving the demons what they wanted, but rather in an unwitting sort of way, they asked for something that backfired on them yet again. So they were cast out of the boy, and now they're being put into the pigs. And now they're casting themselves out of the pigs because even the pigs couldn't handle these demons. So I see it as an example of the power of Jesus and showing the demons kind of a double whammy, their place in the order of things. The second thing is that it may well be, Rod, that there's some great benefit to your father for, as painful as it may sound, that in God's providence, there's some benefit to your father that he's receiving by experiencing dementia, as painful as that is, because there's some greater good intended for him that's invisible to you. That's often how things are in this life, where we can't perceive the good things, or as the Bible says, all things that work together for the good for those who love God, even in dementia or cancer or other painful situations. One thing that has come to my mind before, Rod, I'll just offer this to you as something to think about, would be somebody who's got clarity of mind is capable of committing serious sins. And so it may be a blessing in disguise that your God, knowing what would happen if your father didn't have dementia, that maybe his life would take a turn for the worse and God is protecting him from that. So things like that come to my mind when I think about these difficult situations in life, and that might be something for you to think about. But in no way would I say that God is preferring the requests of demons to the requests of people like you who love him. He's just giving you a different answer, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad God's ways are not my ways, because I don't always understand everything. I just thought I'd see what
you and me both.
Yeah.
You and me both, Rod. I puzzle over things that I see in this life, and I say, Lord, I don't understand that. Why is that that way, or why can't it be this way? And, you know, I guess for me, I'm content to wait to find out when the time comes. But I acknowledge the difficulty.
I guess when we get to heaven, that's one of the questions we could ask, huh?
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know how Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, he says that blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. And I think it's in that being comforted that all will be revealed. So you will receive comfort and peace and happiness in knowing what God's plan was all along, given your dad's dementia. And you will no longer be distressed by it. You will be comforted when you see what God reveals to you, I think.
Well, thank you, Patrick. I really love your show, and I appreciate your comments on that.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Rod. Thank you. And may God bless your father. Let's see. 888-914-9149. We're going out to Raul in Chicago. Good morning, Raul.
Good morning, Patrick. My question is, why do Protestants use the verse in the Bible in the book of Ecclesiastes where it mentions
the book of what?
I don't know how to pronounce it.
Ecclesiastes? Okay, maybe Ecclesiastes? Okay.
Sorry, I can't pronounce it.
Got it.
Okay, so they use the verse where it's, I don't know the verse number, but I believe it says the dead know nothing.
Right.
And they use this before to back up the claim that the saints can hear my prayers.
Right.
So I'd like to know, how could I respond to that?
Yeah, I would respond this way. First of all, it's the language of appearance, because this is chapter 9, verse 5, by the way, for the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. That's the language of appearance. To us, it appears as though they're dead and gone. They don't know anything. They're in the grave. They're done. But that, we know, can't be true, because, for one thing, Jesus appears on Mount Tabor, the Mount of Transfiguration, with two dead people, Moses and Elijah.
Yes.
And they very much know what's going on, and they're talking with Jesus, and they're communicating with him. So that's one example. Also, in Revelation chapter 6, we see the depiction of the martyrs that are beneath the altar in heaven. And not only are they aware of each other and talking to God, they're actually crying out to God, asking God to punish the evildoers who martyred them. And so they're even aware that they're aware of what's going on in earth, because they know that the people who put them to death have not been punished yet. Jesus says there's great rejoicing in heaven when even one sinner repents. So clearly, the saints in heaven, they're aware. How are they aware? We don't know for sure. He doesn't explain that part of it, but he does say that they are aware when even one sinner repents. So what I'm proposing to you here is a way to nullify their bad argument, because they're using that one passage and trying to hang an argument on it, and it just won't hold the weight of that argument, because all you have to do is bring to bear these various other passages that demonstrate that their interpretation of that passage is incorrect. It must be incorrect. Or then all these other passages that talk about the saints in heaven being aware and, you know, they're definitely not unconscious of what's going on, then those verses would have to be wrong. And obviously they're not. So that's how I would approach it. Now, let me recommend an article for you, Raul. I wrote an article just on this topic. It's called Any Friend of God's is a Friend of Mine. And it's free, along with about 36 other articles that I wrote that are available by going to the show page. That's relevantradio.com/Patrick. So jot that down, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Click on links, click on articles, and it's right there. So it's a biblical overview of the communion of saints. What does the Bible say about, can the saints hear us? How do they hear all those prayers? Passages like the one that you brought up, and many other things besides. Those are all covered in that free article called Any Friend of God's is a Friend of Mine. You should get that.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Patrick. You have a good one.
You're welcome. Great chatting with you. And Cyrus, if you think of it, maybe you could post a link to that article, and that's for the benefit of people who are interested. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Fernando in Albuquerque. Good morning, Fernando.
Yes. Hello. Good morning. I love your show, Patrick. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
This is about history. I'm trying to, it's such a broad subject, but there's a guy on YouTube that's been gaining a lot of traction. He make it really brief. He spent like 26 years in prison, and about 20 years of those 26 years, he just read about history books, about what different things that have happened in the world. Basically, he says that every 138 years, something happens, and he calls it the Phoenix phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So to make it brief, he used to be Protestant. Now he doesn't believe in God. But there's a church. I've never heard the church talk about, like, who built the pyramids or who built the megaliths or...
Right. Do me a favor, Fernando. Put it in the form of a question. I want to make sure I answer what you're asking me.
Is there a book, or does the church teach, or can we find out how did these things happen in history? Who built these things?
So it sounds as though, if I had to guess, that you've stumbled across a guy who traffics in esoteric information or pseudo information. I remember a guy, I don't know how old you are, Fernando, but if you're old enough to remember the 1970s, there was this preacher on TV called Gene Scott. And he was this outlandish character. He was for real. He was a real guy, but he was just a kind of a wild man. And he had this following of people who would watch him on TV. It was like the UHF channels. And he would go on and on with these esoteric theories about pyramid inches, and he would explain the interior of the pyramids and how this passageway symbolized Jesus and that passageway symbolized whatever. And if you count the pyramid inches, it will tell you when the end of the world will happen. And all of this superstructure of nonsense, absolute nonsense. But if you just sat there and listened to this guy and gave him half a chance, it would seem to kind of sort of make sense. But it was all just a mishmash of these esoteric theories, and none of it amounted to anything. And I don't know if this guy is kind of picking up the ball where Gene Scott left off. And there are plenty of other people like that too, for that matter. But that's all it is. It's just some guy with the Rubik's Cube of information that he has found, and he's spinning his tales of what these things mean. And my view, who cares? I mean, good old-fashioned history is, I think, the answer to your question. You want to know who built the pyramids? Consult the archaeologists. Consult the historians and the anthropologists and the people with the scientific tools and know-how and experience and training who have studied these things in their academic disciplines, and they can furnish us with some pretty good ideas as to who built the pyramids. Now, some things are still mysterious. That's okay. But I would far, far, far recommend, I would much more recommend to you that you consult bona fide historical sources than the ravings of some guy on YouTube who's probably a lot like Gene Scott. He's got all his theories and they all seem to make sense to him. I wouldn't bother with that stuff, honestly. They're a dime a dozen.
Yeah, it's not that I believe him. I try to interpret things according to the scripture and everything. It just, history fascinates me. And also, a lot of archaeologists have gotten it wrong. So I'm kind of, you know, trying to find out myself, but I was just wondering if the church or talks about any of that stuff, because it's there. I mean, it seems like we ignore it. There's all these mysteries and it's there. So a lot of secular people grab that and they kind of dismiss Christianity because we never talk about it.
Oh, Fernando. You don't need to be troubled over things like that. I mean, the world has always rejected God and God's people. This is nothing new. And the church doesn't need to talk about who built the pyramids, you know. I mean, it's interesting from an historical standpoint, and to whatever extent it may be part of corroborating biblical history, that's good, you know. Biblical Archaeology Review would be a good example of a publication you could subscribe to. And every issue, I subscribed to it for quite a long time back in the day. And it's just issue after issue with all kinds of interesting archaeological, scientific aspects of biblical history. It's really interesting. But the church doesn't need to talk about that. You know, what about the so-called ancient aliens who landed on Earth and we have these giant carvings into sides of mountains and things of horses and people and maybe alien-looking creatures? I suppose in due time, many of those things will be explained. But in the meantime, the church doesn't say anything about ancient aliens or, you know, things of that nature. Those are interesting and mysterious, and that's kind of, you know, interesting, I suppose. But the church doesn't need to discourse on such things because that's not part of divine revelation. And none of those things, and here's the other thing, Fernando, knowing who or where or why those things were put on hilltops and mountainsides, it's not going to get you to heaven. It's not going to send you to hell. It's just, it's a branch of knowledge that's interesting, but it doesn't really have any bearing upon what the church is here to do. That's why you don't see the church talking about things like that. It doesn't need to. That's not its mission. So I know that you may seem a bit crestfallen. My advice to you would be just be careful, because some people have more of an appetite for such esoteric things than others. And some people, you know, I'm not saying it's you per se, but just be careful that you don't wind up getting caught up in this world of, you know, the Rubik's Cube approach to life. Like some guy who was in prison for 30 years, he has the meaning of life all figured out, and he's going to explain to you who the Knights Templar were and who built the pyramids. And I would just ignore all of that stuff because it has no bearing whatsoever on you. Some of his ideas could possibly be right. Probably they're not. But how does that benefit you to watch those videos? I mean, there's so many better things you could do with your time than that. And that's just my honest opinion from a distance. I'll give you the last word, Fernando.
Oh, yes. I was just thinking of a lot of people not believing in God, and they go, they look at that Big Bang and the theory, and maybe knowing about creation, God's creation, would kind of turn them towards this as not, you know, that there is a God. That was kind of like my my point, but yeah, I understand what you're saying. I've stopped watching all those videos. I just want to translate it into biblical terms, I guess, and kind of explain to somebody who believes in the Big Bang and that we come from monkeys and stuff like that.
Well,
but anyways,
fair enough. I mean, you're talking about a variety of different things, so you're kind of alluding there to evolution. The Big Bang, let's keep in mind, that's a scientific theory that, by the way, was proposed initially by a Catholic priest, Father George Lemaître. He was a contemporary of Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein originally thought that it was junk science. And he says, you know, I don't believe this at all. And eventually, when he studied Father Lemaître's mathematics, he came around and he says, yeah, you're right. So my understanding of the current state of the art of, you know, cosmology is that the Big Bang is sort of the theory that obtains until and unless it's ever replaced. But there's nothing wrong with holding that view, the Big Bang. It's part of cosmology. Now, the church does have a lot to say about cosmology, that's for sure. So just be discriminating. Be you know, make the best use of your time would be my advice. Far better that you listen to Relevant Radio than watch those guys' videos. That's just my opinion. I think Father Rocky shares that opinion, though, if you ask him. Hey, thanks, Fernando. You knew this was going to happen, didn't you? I did not request this, but it was inevitable. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? Our sponsor, Creative Planning, has options. More info, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
All right. Love this music. Reminds me of my ute in the 1970s. 888-914-9149. We'll go to Chris now in Feasterville, PA. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Patrick. Patrick, I just have a very brief question regarding the demons that were cast into the herd of swine by Jesus, who then drowned in the river. Would I be correct in assuming actually the demons themselves were not destroyed, correct? They were just, because right. A demon cannot die, they just went on to some other object or subject after the swine died?
Right. And it seems to me that they, after the swine died in the Sea of Galilee, that they left that and were just roaming around as disembodied spirits. I shouldn't say disembodied spirits. They're pure spirits. Angels are. Their souls are not made for bodies like ours are. So my presumption is that they just were roaming, you know, not inside of any particular object. You know, they didn't die for sure.
A demon cannot die, right, Patrick, because right. Immature spirit.
Exactly. Yeah.
Patrick, thank you so very much.
Happy to help and glad we could dispatch that one quickly. Let's go to Francie now in Alexandria, Minnesota. Hi, Francie.
Good morning, Patrick. See, my husband and I are going to be taking a Holy Land pilgrimage in October. And
great.
I was wondering if you would have we're very excited, book recommendation on, you know, the history and the biblical history of some of the places that we'll be seeing.
For sure. Yeah, I would recommend a book by Henri Daniel Rowe. His last name is Daniel-Rops. And it's called Daily Life in the Time of Jesus, and that gives an historical overview of the way things were at that time, language, customs,
beautiful.
Food, geography, culture, all those things. I would
just
recommend.
What I'm looking for.
Okay, do you want a couple more, or is that sufficient?
Sure. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. No problem.
I would also recommend that you read The Diary of a Pilgrimage by a 4th century woman named Egeria, E-G-E-R-I-A, E-G-E-R-I-A. And this is an amazing, amazing, amazing kind of pilgrimage autobiography. She lived in the 300s, and she wrote down the details of her pilgrimage to the Holy Land. And some of the most astonishing things that she saw, like ancient churches that had been built. Now, we're talking in the 300s. So she describes in great detail things like the masses that were celebrated at that time and the things that the monks and other holy people who lived in the Holy Land showed her. This is where Moses died. This is the place where the burning bush happened. This is, you know, all of these things. So it's truly enlightening. And if you want to see the Holy Land as it was through her eyes, at least, you know, 1700, 1800 years ago, this would be the book. So Diary of a Pilgrimage, I would also recommend two books by, what is his first name? Let me get his first name here for you. It's Bargil, B-A-R-G-I-L, Pixner, P-I-X-N-E-R. The first book is called With Jesus in Jerusalem. And the second book is called With Jesus Through Galilee. And both of those will also be very eye-opening for you. So I would recommend those as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. This will be great. Do you have time for one more question that's completely different? We, over the Holy Week, we watched The Passion, Mel Gibson's The Passion.
Right.
And in there, when Jesus was scourged, Pilate's wife, Herodias, came and gave Mary, the two Marys, a stack of white cloths, and they used that to wipe up his blood. Is there some significance to that, and what would that be?
Well, there's no biblical mention of this. You know, all we know is that Herod's wife, or not Herod, that Pilate's wife was troubled about all of this with Jesus in a dream, and she warned her husband to have nothing to do with it. And of course, he didn't take her advice. But that interpolation of the white cloths and all that, that seems to me, is first of all, it doesn't come from the Bible, but it does come, I'm almost positive, from Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich's alleged visions of the passion and death of Jesus. And so those are some of the details that she puts in to her private revelation.
Oh, okay.
And that's something that Mel Gibson drew upon when he was making the movie.
Got it. Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you. That explains it.
You're welcome.
All right. Appreciate it.
Happy to help. Thanks. You're welcome. Let's go to Teresa now in Pearland, Texas. Hello, Teresa.
Yes. Hello. Well, I wanted to say that two things. The one is the memorari is taking the place of a Hail Mary, and the Hail Mary is, you know, it's in the Bible, and the memorari is not in the memorari. I went to Catholic school. I'm in the late 70s age.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And the memorari was, I never ever heard about it until about this year or last year. I don't know. And also the second thing is that we should pray for our leaders, say the Bible, so we can have peace. And also the American Indian chief, he stopped the war years ago because he didn't want his Indians killed anymore. So he stopped the war, and they live in reservations, which is like living in a third world country. And anyways, those two things, because the memorari, you know, is taking the place of the Hail Mary. The Hail Mary is in the Bible, and the memorari, I never heard of it. I went to Catholic school 8 years and graduated in the eighth grade.
You know, for what it's worth, Teresa, I was, I don't know how old you are, but I was in grammar school in the 60s and went to Catholic school, and we were praying the memorari then. It's actually an ancient prayer. It's not in the Bible, that's true. But it's reflective of the things that the Bible says about Mary. Well, thank you for sharing with me that information, Teresa. Thank you. God bless you. Let's go to Marty now in Mejia, Texas. Good morning, Marty.
Hi, Mr. Madrid. How are you doing today?
Doing well, thank you.
Oh, sorry, I forgot. I'm not supposed to do that.
Everybody does. That's okay.
Yes. My first question is, whenever I work Saturdays and I go to confession right after, and most Saturdays I usually go to the gym right after confession. If I know I'm going to the gym, I save my penance for whenever I go to the gym and kind of do like a physical. I add more to my workout according to my penance while I'm saying my penance. What's the legitimacy of that? And you know, instead of doing it there in the pews, in Jesus' presence.
Okay. Well, when you receive your penance, when you go to confession, ideally you should say your penance as soon as you can. Now, it's not always possible. So it's not as though you're committing a sin if you leave church after confession and you, whatever the prayers are that you're given, you say that at some point. But ideally, I would say it as soon as possible, and even better to say it in front of the Blessed Sacrament. So it's better for you, and I think it intensifies and focuses your prayers more if you are praying in front of Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament in the parish church where you went to confession. If you are saying those prayers while you're doing your gym, work out. Well, maybe there's a bit of a mixed motive there, perhaps. You know, it could be that your intention is, you know, just as much for the physical exercise as it is for reciting your penance. So if you're wondering about that, one way you could curb that would be to say, I'm going to say my penance in the church before I go to the gym. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't say your penance while you're working out, but I think you'd be distracted and maybe have a mixed motive. So that's something to think about. What was your next question?
My next question was, I was just wondering if you could define a little bit more the difference between an apologetic and a theologian.
Sure. Okay. Well, a theologian is one who is not only trained in the church's theology, but also does some work in that regard. Could be academic work, research, writing books, that kind of thing. Some people refer to themselves as theologians, but real theologians do the work of theology. And so that involves research, etc. But an apologist is not a theologian. There are theologians who are apologists. I'm thinking of St. John Henry Newman as a great example of a theologian in the truest sense. And he also was an apologist. He defended the Catholic faith. That would be an example of where you can be one and the other. But somebody who is an apologist, let's say somebody working at Catholic Answers or in some other capacity, is not a theologian. The work of an apologist, typically, at least nowadays, would be for a popular audience, taking the timeless truths of the faith, and especially those that are objected to, and responding to them, responding to those objections, and making it understandable to a modern audience. So very, very few apologists are theologians, and probably, if you were to count them all up, you'd find that probably most theologians don't do the work of apologetics. So does that distinction make it a little bit clearer for you?
Yeah, because I was actually thinking the opposite about theologians. I was like, well, if you have a devout Catholic theologian, I was thinking this last night while I was laying in bed, if you have a devout Catholic theologian, he's essentially doing apologetics at the same time. But I was like, there's got to be some different way to define it to make them each distinct from one another.
Well, I would look at it this way. You can have somebody who is a medical doctor who is also a baker. You know, medical doctors do what medical doctors do, and some medical doctors like to do some baking on the side. So they're not mutually exclusive. I'm just saying, in my experience at least, very few apologists. Scott Hahn comes to mind as one, although he doesn't really bill himself as an apologist, but he's done a lot of work in apologetics. But he's a biblical theologian for sure. And he also does some work in the area of apologetics. But generally speaking, you're not going to see a lot of overlap. Doesn't mean it couldn't happen, but typically it doesn't, at least in my experience. Thanks, Marty. Appreciate it. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more of your phone calls. Here's the number to dial, 888-914-9149. You're listening to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
It's the Feast of St. Joseph the Worker, a relatively new feast in the church's calendar, only going back to 1955. And it's good for us to honor St. Joseph, the foster father of Jesus, and to consider today the value of work. Here's what Pope Francis said. Today, May 1st, we celebrate St. Joseph the Worker and begin the month traditionally dedicated to Our Lady. Jesus comes into our history. He comes among us by being born of Mary by the power of God, but with the presence of St. Joseph, the legal father who cares for him and also teaches him his trade. Jesus is born and lives in a family, in the Holy Family. Learning the carpenter's craft from St. Joseph in his workshop in Nazareth, sharing with him the commitment, effort, satisfaction, and also the difficulties of every day. This reminds us of the dignity and importance of work. Work is part of God's loving plan. We are called to cultivate and care for all the goods of creation, and in this way share in the work of creation. Work is fundamental to the dignity of a person. And in this month of May, I would like to recall the importance and beauty of the prayer of the Holy Rosary. Reciting the Hail Mary, we are led to contemplate the mysteries of Jesus, that is, to reflect on the key moments of his life, so that, as with Mary and Saint Joseph, he is the center of our thoughts, of our attention, of our actions. It would be nice if, especially in this month of May, we could pray the Holy Rosary together in the family. Praying together is a precious moment that further strengthens family life and friendship. Let us learn to pray more in the family and as a family.
And the people can laugh at religion and scorn and scoff at it.
Monsignor Charles Pope.
But at the end of the day, how are we doing since we kicked God to the curb? How are we doing? We're not doing better.
The Drew Mariani Show.
There's been a real darkening of the mind and a hardening of the heart. And, of course, we see this violence rippling out into the culture at large. And our leaders and our educators and our entertainment industries all promoting stuff that's just immoral. It's wrong. How do we reclaim the culture?
So I would say younger people, find a good spouse, get married, stay married, raise your kids well, bring them up in the church, homeschool them if you can, get them out of those public schools. We have to just intentionally live the faith that God gave us and practice it. If you're a grandparent or whatever, you got to reach back and say, look, my generation made mistakes. I'm sorry, but I want you to understand something. There is a way back.
The Drew Mariani Show.
The latest news and the issues of the day through the eyes of our faith.
2 p.m. Central on Relevant Radio.
This hour sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
And away we go. 888-914-9149. That's the number to call if you want to be on the air. 888-914-9149. Let's go to the phones. Julian in Patterson, California. Welcome. How old are you, Julian? I'm told you're 12. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's cool.
I'm 12.
All right. Well, welcome. What's your question today?
So the gates of heaven weren't open until Jesus resurrected, right?
Right.
So I was reading the Bible, and in the second book of Kings, it says that Elijah was taken up to heaven. How was that if Jesus hadn't resurrected yet?
Yeah, it's the way to understand that is that he wasn't taken up into heaven, like where God and the angels and all the saints are. He was taken up into the heavens. So he was in this fiery chariot. You remember reading about that? And he was caught up into the heavens. So he disappeared from view from Elisha, who was his protege, his disciple. So he didn't go to heaven because heaven wasn't opened yet, but he went into the heavens, which is what we would call the sky. Like he went up into the sky and then he wasn't seen anymore. So that was a way of being translated or changed from mortality, which you and I are living in now in our mortal lives. And he was changed into immortality. And then he went to the place where all the good and righteous people of the Old Testament were waiting for Jesus to die on the cross. So that's where he went. He didn't go into heaven.
Okay. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm really glad to hear that you're reading the Bible. That's great. Have you started reading the New Testament yet?
No.
I'd recommend. Go ahead, Julian.
Me and my mom, we have like a reading plan. We start from Genesis to Revelation.
Nice. So you're starting at the beginning of those 73 books and you're going to work your way all the way to the end. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. What's that?
All right. My mom told me to tell you that we're doing the Father Mike reading plan.
Oh, very good. It's very popular from what I understand. Well, that's good. Thanks, Julian. Appreciate the question. How about Mary now in Raleigh, North Carolina? Good morning, Mary.
Yes, good morning. I called a couple months ago and asked you a question about the Trinitarian dogma. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you recommended the Frank Sheed book, Theology and Sanity,
yeah.
which I've been reading.
Okay.
And like all good books, it causes you to have more questions.
That's good.
And
that's true. Yeah.
And it started to make me think, so the Trinity was actually present at creation, which is kind of mind-boggling. That I mean, even in John 1:1, they talk about, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question is, if Jesus was at creation, the second person of the Trinity, was he present only in the divine nature? Because his incarnation only was a result of original sin. So I guess my question is, it's a little theoretical, but I know Adam and Eve had free will to commit sin. So had they not sinned, would Jesus always just have had a divine nature at creation, and the incarnation would not have been required, obviously, because there would have been no, you know, quote, enmity between you and the woman and your seed and her seed. And, you know, there would be no, oh, happy fault and all that. I get the reason for the incarnation after the original sin. But I guess my question is, it gets a little theoretical, but like I said, his book is making me have more questions than I think I had before I started.
Well, that's a good thing, because the deeper you go, the more deeply you want to go, for sure. So
yeah.
Let me just say, St. Thomas Aquinas says that even if Adam and Eve had passed their test and had not sinned, that Jesus still would have become incarnate. So that's speculative theology. So we can't say, you know, with certitude, because all we can know is what happened. So but his view is that it was fitting, it's appropriate in his treatise on the incarnation. St. Thomas says that it was appropriate for God to be incarnate as a way to perfect his relationship with human beings. So again, when St. Thomas Aquinas says that, he's saying it kind of speculating to say what would have happened if Adam and Eve had not failed the test.
Right.
So I think we are on safe ground, and especially if you follow his logic and his theological points that he makes in this treatise, I think it's an eminently reasonable position to arrive at. Now, as far as you said, was Jesus present in the creation in his divine nature only? Well, we have to be careful how we use temporal language here, because obviously God as God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, one God in three persons, always exists. So we try to make sense out of that by using temporal language, like from all eternity, God has always existed. That's about as close as we can get to saying that God always exists. There never was a time, and even there we're using temporal language, when God didn't exist. So the creation of the cosmos is in time. And of course, God is outside of time. So it's not as though God was somehow, like God showed up and is like standing there observing as he's creating things. He's outside of time and space. He created time and space. So when we think in terms of history and time within that time frame, yes, God is certainly there, because nothing came into existence, as it says in John chapter 1. You mentioned John chapter 1, and it talks about that. It says, he was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. So in terms of the creation, whether it's angels or the material universe or universes, if there's more than one, who knows, these are all things that were made directly by Jesus. Now, not Jesus, the incarnate Lord, but the second person of the Trinity. So that's why I say we have to be careful, because the question that you're asking actually straddles time and eternity. We could answer it from the standpoint of history, but we would also answer it from the standpoint of eternity And in any case, God, as God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, was present all the time, including, obviously, when creation was coming to existence. How does that sound as an answer?
So this treatise on incarnation by Aquinas, is that something readily available, or can I Google it? Or?
Yeah, it's online. I have it in book form in the volumes. Okay. So if you want the Latin on the left page and the English on the right page, that's what I have. I can recommend a very good book on the topic that will take you even deeper than what you've read thus far with Frank Sheed, and I think you'll really enjoy it. It's called The Trinitarian Christology of St. Thomas Aquinas.
Huh.
And wow. The Dominican friar who wrote it is Dominic Legge, L-E-G-G-E. Dominic Legge. And I believe it's published by Oxford University Press, but it's very good. I mean, it's really deep, rich theology, but it's going to go even further into this question that you're asking, Mary.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the timeline point.
You're
point
welcome.
Well taken.
Happy to help, Mary. And if you just Google Thomas Aquinas Incarnation, you'll find it. It's in English. It's online. Various organizations have the Summa Theologiae in English online. So you should be able to find it. And just to give you your bearings, so it's in the third part of the Summa. And it's the very first question in the third part, the fittingness of the incarnation. 888-914-9149. How about Emily now in Auburn, California? Good morning, Emily.
Hi, good morning. I was actually just kind of curious on what your favorite prayer is. Like if there's some kind of prayer that you think is like better than others, or I just was kind of curious on what you would think.
Well, I don't know that I have a favorite prayer, but if I had to say, is there any prayer better than any other prayer, I would go with the Our Father, the Lord's Prayer, because Jesus himself gave it to us, and you can't improve upon that, can you? So when his disciples said, Lord, teach us to pray, he said, when you pray, pray like this. And he gives us the Our Father, which encompasses everything from prayers of praise and glory to God, but also prayers of petition, prayers of repentance. Really, any kind of prayer you can pray is encapsulated in the Our Father. So that's a prayer I pray many times a day, and I think every other prayer should be seen in light of that prayer that Jesus gave to us.
Cool. Thank you very much for
You're
your
welcome.
Input.
If I can ask you a question, did you by chance write me an email this morning?
I had written you one yesterday.
Okay. So I read your email. I don't know if you heard me read it. And I hope that what I said in response to it was helpful to you.
Oh, I will have to go see what she says. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. It was in the first hour of the program today. So, yeah, if you want to go back and listen to it, because I know that in your email you seemed a bit bothered by, you know, what you wrote to me about. And so I offer you my thoughts on that, and hopefully it won't bother you anymore. Thanks, Emily. Great hearing from you. Let's go to Noel now in Chicago. Hi, Noel.
Hello. Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Welcome.
Well, I just wanted to add, you had a lady caller earlier this morning. She was almost complaining about the Memorare versus the Hail Mary. Incidentally, I just got hired at the hospital here in Chicago in the South Side. It's called St. Bernard Hospital. And I wasn't familiar with the saint, so I started reading on him, and I forgot already what I read. But what stuck to my mind was he was so Marian that he decided to compose a prayer, and it read, "Remember, almost Virgin." It was the Memorare.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, "Oh, that's a nice coincidence." So I just wanted to add to the lady that, like you said, it's an ancient prayer. I forgot 1200 or 1500.
It's about 800 years old. Yeah, it goes back to Saint Bernard, about 800 years ago, right? That's true.
Okay, I just wanted to add that for the lady.
Kind of you. I appreciate that. So did you say you got tired of the hospital or you got hired at the hospital?
I just got hired.
Hired,
in the hospital.
Okay. Yeah. I was gonna say, if you get tired, that's not a bad place to be tired. You can lie down.
No, I'm impressed, though. My future supervisor showed me around, and they had a chapel. When he showed me the chapel, it was the size of a church. So I was like, Lovely. This is a chapel?
That's great. And it's open. Well, when you go in that chapel on your break sometime, be sure to say a prayer for us, Noel. We'd sure appreciate it.
I definitely will, Patrick.
Thank you. And all success to you in your new employment. That's a great thing. By the way, for those of you who work in the field of medicine, whether you're a physician or a nurse or a pharmacist or in some other way you're involved, there's a really good book that you should read. It's called Life Issues, Medical Choices. Life Issues, Medical Choices. And it's a book for people in the healthcare industry, not just people in the healthcare industry. It's for people in radio too, people like me. But it's a really good book that will help you understand what the issues are and where the lines are in some of these bioethical dilemmas that you might find yourself in from time to time. So Life Issues, Medical Choices by Dr. Janet Smith and Dr. Chris Kazor. They're not medical doctors, they're PhDs. But this is rich with information. And even if you're not in the world of medicine, but you're just interested in knowing, well, what should a nurse do in this situation? Should she do this or not do this and why? That's the kind of book that can really help you. So check it out. Life Issues, Medical Choices. We are about to embark on hour 3, which will begin in just moments. So please don't go anywhere because I'll be right back right after this.
Isn't that a daisy?